Governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. When can that become a threat to our liberty? Next on Principles and Policies. Welcome to the Saturday edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Barry Sheets, Executive Director of the Institute for Principled Policy, and along with me is my Vice Chairman, sidekick, and good friend, Chuck Michaels.
Good to be with you and good to be with the folks.
Folks, if you've been following us during our weekday program, you know that we've been talking about Article 5 of the United States Constitution. Article 5 is the article that allows for amendments to be made to our Constitution in cases of necessity. When we find that certain situations have come up in our country where we have a need to spell out in more detail how the relationship between our national government, our state governments, and the people need to work. What we've been talking about this week is an effort by some of our Ohio state legislators, Senator Bill Coley and others, to petition Congress through Senate Joint Resolution 2 to call for an Article 5 Federal Constitutional Convention for the purpose of adding certain amendments to the United States Constitution related to our economic crisis, specifically a balanced budget amendment, a line item veto amendment for the president, and for biennial rather than annual budgeting. We've explained to you this week why we consider that to be a very dangerous gambit. But what I wanted to talk to you about today, and what Chuck and I are both looking at talking about today, is going into more detail about the fact that our founders, when we formed our new government, had a reason for forming it, and they specifically spelled it out in the Declaration of Independence. You know, and everybody knows that section, Chuck, about, you know, we hold these truths to be self-evident,
right,
that all men are created equal.
And this is one of those places where you have to remember, you cannot understand the Constitution except in the light of the Declaration of Independence.
That's exactly correct, Chuck, because actually, as we like to say, the Declaration is the preamble to the preamble of the Constitution. As a matter of fact, it is part of the organic law of the land that is recognized by our Congress as part of our organic law. When you look at the United States Code, which is our body of laws that the federal government have to operate by, you open the book, the first one, and right there it lists the organic laws of the country, which include the Articles of Confederation, amazingly, because they were one of our first laws.
That's right. They're part of the organic law of the United States.
That's right. The Declaration of Independence, the U.S. Constitution, and I believe the Northwest Ordinance of 1787 is in there somewhere as well.
Yeah, I actually had an attorney challenge me once on, he says, I've never heard the term organic law. And I'm like, I don't know how you got through law school without hearing that. But here's what it means.
Exactly.
It has to do with, it basically is the basic law of any nation. And in fact, Black's Law Dictionary has a very fine definition in there, and I can't quote it off the top of my head, but I went online and, yeah, and cut it and pasted, and voila.
Well, actually, I have it right here. It's funny you said Black's Law, because that's where I was going to. Black's Law Dictionary, in their fourth edition, defines organic law as, quote, the fundamental law or constitution of a state or a nation, written or unwritten. That law or system of laws or principles which defines and establishes the organization of its government. So, see, that's the whole idea. It's those things, those basic beliefs and principles, whether written down or from our heritage from English common law, that they're common, they're known to everybody, that help us to form and give shape to and restrict and limit our government from being tyrannical.
Yeah, and it's interesting. I also was challenged by the same attorney on the idea that American law was based on common law. So I had to point him to the Seventh Amendment, which states it explicitly, although it's implied throughout the Constitution. It states implicitly that common law cannot be abrogated.
Yes, and that's exactly right. But the reason why we're bringing you here today, folks, is because we need to unpack this a little bit more so you understand where we've been and where we might potentially be going to if we are to accept the notion that's been put forth by some of our elected officials that it's okay to call for a constitutional convention because, well, we can control it, or we can tell the delegates what they can and can't talk about. And, or the states, even if the convention does become a runaway, and you'll find that when you press them hard enough, they'll all finally admit that, yes, okay, the convention can become a runaway, because obviously everything that we're saying that says that it can't become a runaway, you have actually documented fact to show that it can be.
Right.
They finally get down to the point of, well, okay, even if the convention has a runaway, well, the states have to ratify this thing, and so the states can turn it back.
And that's a major problem, as we discussed in that last show.
That's right.
Basically, the ratification procedure for the Articles of Confederation was completely bypassed in favor of the new ratification procedure of the new document that was to become the new organic law of the country.
That's right.
Now, another thing we need to point out is that, there is no such thing as a runaway convention.
No.
That is a category error. A runaway convention cannot be, because a convention does what a convention will do, and that is, since it is the highest lawmaking body of any body politic, it makes law for that body, and it can make new law that the legislatures must obey. In fact, I had to laugh because Lawrence Tribe has a rather famous letter that the pro-convention advocates are floating out there that says, well, since any result of a convention would have to be vetted by a court. And I kind of laughed at that, and I said, well, except that the convention has the power to dissolve the courts.
Exactly. Because honestly, ladies and gentlemen, that gets us back into an Article 3 discussion, which we're going to briefly just tiptoe into right now, and that any court except the United States Supreme Court can be dissolved by an act of Congress.
That's right.
The federal courts, the U.S. courts of appeals, all of our federal court system, except for the United States Supreme Court, by our Constitution, are established from time to time by Congress. That time to time means that they have a specific beginning and can have a specific ending. Yes. The only court that is organic or fundamental to our entire system is the United States Supreme Court in our national system. However, a convention can dissolve even that, because, Chuck, I think what it really gets down to is what we're saying is a convention is that body that's going to be writing those principles which define and establish the organization of the government.
And that's exactly correct.
Now, you know what? Our founders were very concerned about that even before the Articles of Confederation, specifically before the Constitution, when they drew up the Declaration of Independence. Because if you think about this, this was a notice that we're throwing off the government of Great Britain. That wasn't something that they did lightly, or they just decided. They got people together and took a poll and said, oh, well, 51.3% of the population says we need a new form of government, so let's go do it, guys. No, they did this carefully. And as a matter of fact, in that second paragraph of the Declaration, they spelled out specifically some reasons and concerns. Now, what I want to say is, you know, we all know that whole idea about inalienable rights and life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. Very few people keep reading or have got this committed to their memory or to their hearts. The next words say that to secure these rights, those life, liberty, pursuit of happiness rights, governments are instituted among men. So we have to have government. I'm sorry for all of our anarchist friends out there, but there is no such thing as a society with no government whatsoever.
That's
because
right.
Then you have no rights. You cannot secure a right without some way of enforcing the right.
It's impossible to run a government by privately constructed contracts, because in the case of a breach of the contract, who will enforce it?
Well, and that's the whole point. We can do an entire different show on that one. But going on into the Declaration of Independence, it basically says that whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, in other words, governments are instituted to secure our basic rights of life, liberty, and property, which is what pursuit of happiness is.
And it's their only purpose.
And it's their only purpose. Whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people. You notice it didn't say it wasn't the right of the state legislatures. It wasn't the right of the courts. It wasn't the right of Congress. It was the right of the people. A little English lesson, folks. In the 1700s, the rules of grammar were slightly different than they are today, and capitalization was not just for proper nouns or for the beginning of sentences or for formal place names. Capitalization was used in the place of what we would use today as bold and italic letters.
To especially in handwritten documents, which these are.
Which these are, to draw a point of a particular concept or phrase that the founders found important. If you look in your declaration, the word right and the word people are in capital letters. So it's the people's right to alter or to abolish that form of government and to institute new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them, the people, shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness. Now, ladies and gentlemen, as we talk about a convention, and the reasons why it's dangerous to call for an Article 5 Federal Constitutional Convention is that, and I think Chuck explained this earlier this week in his discussion, and I'll have you reiterate that a little bit here, Chuck, that when a convention is called, when the delegates are seated, the gavel is dropped, at that point, that body is it. They are the penultimate lawmaking body in that country because they are the representatives of the people, capital P.
That's right. And penultimate is a good word to use because the final say is had by whatever the ratification procedure is.
That's right. And as we've discussed on earlier programs, even our existing Constitution would not have passed.
And almost didn't.
Well, it certainly would not have if the ratification procedures of the existing government, the existing organic law of the time, which was the Articles of Confederation, had to have been used for the ratification of the new document because the Articles of Confederation required unanimous consent of all 13 colonies.
Well, that raises a question that we're not going to go into here. But the fact is that when George Washington took the oath of office for the first time, there were only 11 states in the Union.
There were only 11 in the Union.
Now, what does that tell you? How come it didn't take effect for all 13 without ratification because the nine had?
Well, I'll tell you what. We're going to leave that for a later show, folks. I'll tell you what. If you guys think you know the answer, go to our website at principledpolicy.com and drop us an email and if whoever gets the answer correctly,
that's right,
I will send you a free resource from our catalog. We have a number of books and resources, audio tapes, videos.
We have DVDs that aren't even listed. So
that's right. I'll tell you what. If somebody can get the right answer to that, now we're going to do this as a future
Let's
program.
Let's state it clearly.
State it very clearly.
Okay, here's the question. How could it be that in the new Union, when George Washington took the oath of office in 1789, why was it that there were only 11 states in the Union instead of 13?
Okay, now, ladies and gentlemen, like I said, and again, just like with anything else when we teach our Institute on the Constitution classes, when we ask the Constitution quiz questions, you need to basically give us article and section.
Yes.
In other words, you have to give your answer and then define it based upon these historical documents. So anybody who wants to do that, go to our website at principledpolicy.com, drop us an email. You can send it to director@principledpolicy.com or vicechairman@principledpolicy.com, and let us know what you think. What's the answer to that question? The person who gets it right will announce on the air, and we'll send you a free resource valued at least $10.
At least.
Yeah. At least $10 value. Okay, so going back to what we're talking about here and this idea of a penultimate effort is the fact that the delegates then, when they craft whatever they craft, regardless of whether they are restricted or quote-unquote runaway, just like our first convention, they can determine the ratification procedures, and those ratification procedures could either include or not include the state legislatures.
That's right.
State conventions. The courts,
even under Article 5, it's up to the Congress to decide whether it goes to whether the state legislatures can approve or whether it has to go to a convention. Because, for instance, as I just learned, and I didn't realize this, the repeal of I think the 18th, which was the ban on sale of liquor. I can't remember the number.
Prohibition.
I think it's 18. That one had to be done by ratification convention, which I didn't realize until someone told me. And that changed the picture because someone said Utah probably would not have approved of that
right.
through their state legislature, but by a ratification convention, they did.
Well, I'll save our constitutional teacher. You got it right. It was the 18th Amendment, which prohibited the sale, importation, manufacture, et cetera, of alcoholic beverages. And it was the 21st Amendment
that
repealed it. So. Yeah. I'll save our constitutional teacher here. He got it right, even though he was okay.
I was a little mushy. Yeah, I get mushy on those high numbers.
Well, that's okay. You know, honestly, folks, that's the reason why neither one of us want to be called constitutional experts or constitutional scholars, is because we're average citizens just like you, except we're taking time to look into this, to read into the history, to read the founding documents, to read the original writings of our founders, and to read thinkers and writers who were in and around that time period to see what they thought about it.
But if you want to understand original intent, you have to read the writers.
Original documents.
Read the writers that they were reading.
But so going back, our founders understood that people do have the right to change their government. But what they said was that those governments should not be changed for light and transient causes. Now, the big problem we have today is we have a number of folks, a number of groups that are desperate to change our form of government. They're desperate to throw off the chains of the Constitution, as Thomas Jefferson referred to, so that they can have more flexibility. We've heard it from the highest levels. We've heard our president say, quoted, that I wish I didn't have to deal with the Congress to get my agenda through. You know, in other words, he wants to legislate by executive order. What keeps him from doing it? The United States Constitution. Article 1, Section 8, Article 1, Section 1, which puts all legislative authority is in a Congress of the United States. So he can't do it. Our Congress would like to be able to go ahead and pass laws willy-nilly and never have the courts say anything about it. But our Constitution allows for the courts to be able to look at laws and see if they fit within the bounds of our Constitution. Now, our big problem today is our courts are turned up on their ears, and instead of interpreting the laws by the Constitution, they start interpreting the Constitution by their own case precedents. In other words, the arguments that we made in the past, we're going to use to say this is what the Constitution means today. Or as I believe it was Justice Blackett said, the Constitution means what the judges say it means.
Charles Evans Hughes,
that's right. Charles Evans Hughes said that the Constitution means exactly what the judges say it means.
It's a paraphrase, but yeah.
Yeah, okay. All right, we'll get
it. You're very close.
I'm getting
there. It's not that far from it. sitting around memorizing, I'd rather sit around and memorize Bible verses, honestly, and
amen.
I'm terrible at that as well.
Amen.
Very good at paraphrasing, very bad at
Here's a Bible verse, and maybe I'm paraphrasing it for some because I'm probably reading out of a different edition than some people do. But it says that do not remove the ancient boundaries which your fathers have set.
Do not move the ancient landmarks, yeah.
Well, and folks, we have an ancient landmark. It's called the Constitution of the United States. It was most of its provisions have been based in a healthy understanding of the biblical frameworks.
And that's an important point.
Yes, it is.
Because it's based on landmarks that go back much further than 230 years.
Right. But now we have an effort, again, Senate Joint Resolution 2 in the Ohio Senate, that's asking Congress to call for a new convention. Folks, as we've said before, this is one area where we do think precedent is important. Unlike the courts where they use precedent, i.e. their own decisions, to interpret the Constitution, we must use precedent to see what happened in the past, and we've talked about this earlier in the week, that everything that we see from an original convention shows that all of the arguments that our elected officials are making today as to why a constitutional convention can be controlled or guided and directed by the states, those were the same arguments or thoughts that the original colonies had when they sent their delegates to that original convention, and we have a new form of government.
And actually, they were in better control of a constitutional convention because they were guaranteed the right to pick the delegates by their own criteria.
By their own criteria at that point in time. Now, that's one area that I'm sure that our friends in the Ohio Senate would argue with us on and say, well, if you're standing on precedent, then the precedent is we get to choose our own delegates. Yes, that's true, because at that time, the Continental Congress, if you look at the list of delegates, many of them were members of the Continental Congress.
Well, that's right.
So let's move the clock forward 220-some-odd years. My math's bad today.
That's okay.
But let's move the clock forward.
224.
We now have a Congress that is polarized. We have a Congress that right now we've got parties fighting over how the lines on the map are going to be drawn as to who gets to represent who in Congress. Do we really think that Congress is going to basically hand off the selection of delegates to the states? They're right now, they're fighting over the states deciding what the congressional boundaries look like.
Well, look, believing that suddenly the federal government is going to hand over state sovereignty that they've spent the last 150 years taking from the states on the mere demand of some state legislatures is a fool's errand. It's yes. not going to happen. The federal government will do its utmost to maintain every bit of power that they have. And this is why we always were sort of incredulous during the Reagan years when they talked about the new federalism. Well, the new federalism was, we have all the power at the federal level, but we're going to allow the states to have a little bit of say. Well, gee, thanks, fellas. The fact is that that was state sovereignty. It belongs to the states. And the fact that the states refuse to take it back is a black mark on their record.
Yeah, it is. But we have a number of states now that are trying an experiment. I'll put it that way. They're trying an experiment of trying to reclaim their state sovereignties. Arizona, with looking at the whole issue with illegal immigration and whether or not Arizona can set their own immigration laws.
Well, it's not even that. Is Arizona allowed to enforce the existing federal law?
Well, you see that it's even deeper. We're going to have a program on that here soon, ladies and gentlemen. So, as we're talking here and we kick up ideas, we're like, oh yeah, that'd make a good program. But the program we're talking about today is this Article 5 convention. Now, honestly, ladies and gentlemen, this Article 5 convention issue is one that many groups, good, well-meaning groups, patriot-minded groups, oftentimes when you talk to them about it on first blush, they're all for it. They think it's a great idea.
Yeah.
We need a balanced budget. Yeah, the president really needs a line item. Well, that harkens back to Reagan's era. That was the big thump back then was Reagan needs a line item veto. Well, Reagan doesn't need it, and neither does Barack Obama or anybody else who's coming after
him. Or Bill Clinton or anybody else.
And
that's what people seem to forget. They want to give presidents they like certain powers, and they want somehow they're going to expire before the next party takes office.
But see, that's the big problem with an amendment. Once it's ratified, it does not expire.
And that
until,
is why,
like 18th Amendment you brought up, until another amendment comes along
that
specifically invalidates the previous amendment, it's in effect.
Well, remember, you and I were both in opposition to faith-based federal programs,
right?
As church welfare, and some of the people who we were dealing with, it was why George Bush wouldn't do anything, but I said, make Hillary Clinton president and see if you really want her to be in charge of a faith-based program from the White House.
Well,
we got somebody else, but the net effect is the same.
Yeah, again, but that's the whole point, folks, is that what we're trying to get to here with this particular issue is that our history, the precedent that was set by our first constitutional convention, all point to the fact that if we tried to do this again in convention, we would basically be handing over our government, our entire form of government, to the unknown. Because, number one, we don't have the statesmen who had a large holistic view of not only their own country, not only their foundations of their belief, but of international law. I mean, these men, our founders, studied international thinkers like Hugo Grotius and Imrich Vattel, and numerous, when it comes to international law.
Pufendorf.
Yeah.
Samuel
Pufendorf and others. These are names that you probably haven't heard of before, but these are names that our founders were intimately familiar with because these are the works that they were reading.
Yeah, read them in Greek and Latin.
Exactly. they didn't just read John Locke and Jean-Jacques Rousseau and things of people of that nature, but they went back and read people like St. Paul. They read people like, we mentioned Pufendorf, biblical thinkers.
Augustine.
Yeah,
Saint Augustine.
Saint Augustine. So those we don't have that caliber of statesman anymore. I mean, know that there are a number of people who aspire or ascribe to that, but realistically, the vast majority of those who have come on the national stage, I always hear the same word coming out of their mouth, which shows to me that they haven't studied. They talk about the United States as a democracy.
All right.
And if you've studied our form of government, if you've studied those organic laws of the United States, if you've studied the Constitution in and of itself, you'll understand that we're far from a democracy.
We're a republic, and the document says so. I'd like to rein in for a second, because let's go back and talk about where the ancient boundaries are moved in this case, because that's an important consideration.
Yes.
Now, one of the things about taking this risk, about handing things over to an unknown, we are a split nation at this point.
Yes, we are.
We are schizophrenic. There is a certain view of government that's the old view, and that is that government exists to secure men's rights. And then there's a view of government that it is there to be providential. It is to provide, not to give you freedom from tyranny and suppression of your rights, but to give you freedom from hunger, from want, from ignorance, and those kind of things are government's job. So what we should probably do is talk about, first of all, read that section in the Declaration of Independence so we can understand. It talks about inalienable rights or unalienable rights.
Mm-hmm.
And quote it real quick.
Okay, basically it says, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
Okay, so the concept there is for inalienable rights. In other words, a right and from which you cannot be separated because it is an intrinsic value of you. It can be suppressed by a tyrant, but it cannot be taken away. You have it because God gave it to you. Let's look at a model constitution. This is a very telling thing. This is called the New States Constitution.
Now let's give the people a little bit of a little brief here. This constitution is the document that was created by funding from the Ford Foundation by a man by the name of Rexford Tugwell, who was paid to write this. Now, Rexford Tugwell was also known because during I believe it's the Johnson administration, he was part of the group of Americans.
Oh, he was one of Roosevelt's brain trust.
He was part of Roosevelt's brain trust, but even later on, he worked at the United Nations to craft the foundational
That's
documents
right.
for world governance.
He wrote a model world constitution.
That's right.
For the United Nations.
That's right.
So, and for the Ford Foundation.
So, right, exactly. So Rexford Tugwell, who is the author of the book, The Emerging Constitution, where you find a copy of the new Constitution of the New States, this was Tugwell's take on what a model government should look like in America, when we got a constitutional convention to throw off the old government.
That's right. Now, just for instance, I'm going to read from Article 1, which is a section labeled Rights. So the Bill of Rights are Article 1 in the New States Constitution.
Very well.
Now, okay, here's Section 1. Freedom of expression, of communication, of movement, of assembly, or of petition shall not be abridged except in declared emergency.
Wait a minute. What happened to freedom of speech, freedom of religion, freedom of the press, freedom of association? Because if I'm looking in our current Constitution, that's the Bill of Rights as well, and it's in Article 1, that Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof or abridging the freedom of speech or of the press or of the right of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition the government for redress of grievances. There's nothing in here about declared emergencies.
But let's take a look at what Section 2 of the New States Constitution says.
Okay, great. I have another question too, but go ahead.
Access to information possessed by governmental agencies shall not be denied except in the interest of national security. But communication among officials necessary to decision-making shall be privileged.
So basically, internal documents among government officials, nobody gets to see.
Well, here, this goes along. Here's Section 3. It goes along with it.
Public, so there, I guess there goes freedom of the press and freedom of petitioning the government for redress of grievances.
Oh, hold on. We have an entirely different name now.
Okay.
Public communicators.
Oh.
Public communicators may decline to reveal sources of information, but shall be responsible for hurtful disclosures.
Oh, Chuck, I really want to go back, though, because before we move farther into this, which honestly, ladies and gentlemen, I think you can understand what we're getting at here, is that we're talking about an Orwellian 1984 Brave New World kind of structure here, where other people determine for you what your rights are. Now, the point I wanted to get back to was in that first section that you read, that it says that you have all of these rights. And the right of movement kind of scares me. Does that mean they get to bind me up and lay me on a street corner if I lose that right? But the point I'm going to ask is...
it's more your papers, please.
Your papers, please.
We want to see your papers.
That's right. In other words, you're going to get checked at every border. My concern is it says that all of those rights are there, but can be taken away in times of declared emergencies.
Emergency.
Who declares the emergency?
Exactly. Well, I can tell you that further on in this document, that all goes to the executive head of government. The president gets to declare emergency.
Oh, so in other words, basically with this document, we become a de facto monarchy.
Yes, the president becomes an elective monarch.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, the reason why we're saying this is not because we're dealing in science fiction or fantasy. It's because this is an actual, serious, honest to everything document that was developed by someone who's very close in government, by thinkers who were getting paid by large foundations with serious money. Now, we're talking about, this was developed, I believe, in the early 1970s, was it not?
1967 or 68.
Okay, even a little bit earlier. That was real money. I believe, if I remember correctly, that the Ford Foundation funneled over $1 million into this project.
Oh, it was multiple millions.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, you know, if you understand anything about inflation and the value of the dollar, that would be like somebody say, like, oh, maybe George Soros today pumping in tens of millions of dollars to get a think tank or a group of people together to rewrite our Constitution. It's already been done. It's sitting there. Ladies and gentlemen, the new state's Constitution is out there. It is one of the better-kept secrets of the radical left movement.
Well, for instance, parts of it have already been implemented.
I was hoping we had time to talk about that.
I think we do. We have plenty of time here. One of the things that came in very early from this model, and it was to show you that it has nothing to do with party label, was implemented by Richard Nixon. And that is the breaking up of the country into 10 administrative districts.
Okay, now wait a minute, though, Chuck. I mean, whether or not that happened, our states are still working as states, right?
Up to a point. I mean, essentially, the states have now been more or less relegated to an administrative district role. They have no real sovereignty anymore. Everybody cites the 14th Amendment and sues the state to get this or that or another thing.
That's true. And, you know, the more I think about it, and I think, ladies and gentlemen, you in the audience, you might understand this too. We always hear about all these compacts that are being signed, whether it be, you know, water compacts or land compacts or whatever. But it's usually regions that are signing them together, groups of states that are coming together and signing and saying, we're going to do this economic development pact between these three states.
Well, for instance, our region, if I remember right, I haven't seen the borders for years. I used to know what the borders were. We're basically the old Northwest Territory states, and most of the old Northwest Territory states are in our particular region. There's a Southwest region, there's a Northeast region, there's a Southeast region. They don't talk about it much anymore, but don't kid yourself. A lot of these administrative agencies will have an office in the major city inside the region, and that's where things get done from for that particular region. Regional government is a big thing in the new states model. One of the things, too, I wanted to talk about, besides the parts of it that are being implemented, and another part of it that's being implemented is, think about what we just read about the freedom of expression, communication, of movement, is it can be taken away in times of declared emergency. Well, guess what, folks? That's the Patriot Act.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Which is a clear and open violation of the 4th, 5th, 6th, 7th, and 8th Amendments, not to mention the 9th and the 10th. And yet the courts keep saying, well, you know, warrants still have to be issued. You can issue a warrant after the fact. You can do a search and a seizure and then issue a warrant afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
That's part and parcel of this model. And the model is moving the landmark that you have unalienable rights. That is, your rights are no longer inalienable. They are given to you by government. They aren't guaranteed by government anymore. And that's a difference in the viewpoint. That's why we're a split nation. There are people that view that rights are an intrinsic part of you. And there are people who believe that rights come from government, and whatever government says, if we all get together in a big huddle and decide that Barry needs to be bald unnaturally, then we all get to hold him down.
It's coming naturally.
Welcome to the club, brother. We all get to hold him down and shave his head, and there's nothing he can do about it.
Well, wait a minute, because that's restricting my right to movement. Oh, but I guess it's an emergency.
It's an emergency.
I need to have my head shaved.
And you wouldn't acquiesce, and therefore we have the right as the people with the power, because power grows out of the barrel of a gun.
That's true.
To hold you down and shave your head because you would not mm-hmm. assent.
Okay, Chuck, I just want to go back to something you were talking about these administrative regions. Folks, if you don't believe this, here, I'll spell them out for you because I found the map. I think there are, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. There's 9 regions. Not 10, but there's 9. There's the New England region. There's the Middle Atlantic region. There's the South Atlantic region. There's the East South Central region, the West South Central region, the West North Central region, and then the one that we're in Ohio, the East North Central, which includes Michigan, Wisconsin, Illinois, and Indiana, along with Ohio.
Northwest Territory, but pretty close.
Well, Minnesota was kind of an anomaly there with the Northwest Territory. The East North Central, the Mountain Region, and the Pacific Region. Those are the... Now, it's funny that because the map, the way they describe this, these are the census regions. So there's a cover here for the reason why we broke the state down into these administrative regions. It was for the ease of doing the census. But as we understand, ladies and gentlemen, part of the census information, they're breaking down regions and individuals in the regions, and they're trying to find out something about you. And we just went through the census. Now, I don't know how many of you filled out the census, got the long form or the short form, but if you got the long form, they were asking an awful lot of interesting questions about you and how you live.
I have filled out now 3 census forms, 30 years worth.
Yes.
Every single time I have gotten the long form, and every single time I have been threatened because I refuse to fill out the long form, they get to hear how many people live in my house, what their ages are. I don't even fill out the race part. Basically, they want to, you know, it says race. I always put other and write in human. So, and come find me if you think you can get away with it. Please do it. We had one census worker come to the door, and I said, you know, you could be fined. And I go, please do so. I really want to be a test case. Which they don't do.
But even so, ladies and gentlemen, right now in our current form of government, our rights are being pressed.
That's right.
Our freedoms, our inalienable rights to liberty and happiness. I mean, we can look at things like the Patriot Act and others, but those are topics for another show I don't really want to go into in depth right today. But the point is, Chuck's right. There are parts of the new Constitution of the new states, this document that was funded by multi-million-dollar grants from big private foundations, written by a man who helped write the world constitution model for the United Nations to change America into a group of administrative regions with a monarch-like chief executive.
Well, here's the reason that the new state's constitution was written. And it's stated in this book. And the book is called The Emerging Constitution. And it's written by Rexford Tugwell. It's out of print, but you can buy copies at Google. Barry and I both bought copies relatively cheap.
Yes,
I think you got yours for $15. I think I paid $20. It's a big, thick book. It's over 600 pages. But the stated purpose in the book is to allow the United States, to prepare the United States, to make it able to be intermixed in a new world government. it would be to match the United States philosophically with the rest of the world so that we can be melded into a world government. Rexford Tugwell was very open about this. He was a globalist, and he wanted the United States as a big hunk of a... He wanted us to be the regional leaders, the regional government leaders, and hence the North American Union. They were trying to mix us into, get us into the North American Union first with this mixture of governments. And what you see is a change in philosophy of government. For instance, let me read another part of the rights. This is Section 10 of rights. Article 1, those who cannot contribute to productivity shall be entitled to a share of the national product, but distribution shall be fair. There's that word we discussed last week, if you recall.
Wait a minute, isn't that what a group of folks out there called Occupy Wall Street screaming about is fairness?
Exactly, and this is why the Constitutional Convention plays right into the hands of those who want a new constitution.
Okay.
Let's see. Distribution shall be fair, and the total may not exceed the amount for this purpose held in the National Sharing Fund.
Why do I feel all warm and fuzzy?
Yeah.
The National Sharing Fund.
The National Sharing Fund.
So basically what we're saying is everybody's productive wealth is going to be collected by this new government and then redistributed in a fair manner.
Quote, unquote, fair.
Okay, that sounds like rampant socialism to me.
It is rampant socialism.
Okay, well, you know what, ladies and gentlemen? I did a little backgrounding here. I've read some of the book, but I'd forgotten the numbers. So I did a little digging here. Actually, this whole project to create this constitution, now I want to tell you how serious this thing is, ladies and gentlemen. You listen to these numbers, and then you tell me whether or not we're in a fantasy land or not. And I don't think we are. 1964, the Ford Foundation commissioned this work. They commissioned it through an outfit called the Center for the Study of Democratic Institutions.
Yes.
Have you heard of that one, ladies and gentlemen? You probably have because they're still around.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Basically, the foundation wanted a new constitution. So in 64, think about this, 1964, they started funding this. After 40 drafts, a staff of more than 100 at the Center for the Study of Democratic Institutions, and $2.5 million per year after 10 years. In 1974, the Constitution for the New States of America was unveiled. So that's a $25 million investment and a staff of 100 people over a 10-year window to bring this document to light. Okay?
Yeah, the copyright on this book,
yes.
1974.
Now, so this book was supposed to be the supporting documentation for driving the new state's constitution.
And this is a first edition, so.
Yeah, that's a first edition. So, ladies and gentlemen, that book that Chuck has is the product of $25 million worth of investment by the Center for the Study of Democratic Institutions and a 10-year project to create the document that we're talking to you about today. The proposed constitution for the new states of America.
And if I'm not mistaken, the Ford Foundation spent another $17 million to promote a new constitution through the 70s.
And in 1976, then Senate President Nelson Rockefeller introduced a resolution calling for a constitutional convention. Under the auspices of balancing the budget.
That's right.
Ladies and gentlemen, this thing has been around for almost 40 years of calls from quote unquote Republican or conservatives. I don't think you'd call Nelson Rockefeller a conservative, but even back then he was considered more conservative than most, calling for a federal Article 5 constitutional convention for the purposes of balancing the federal budget and getting spending under control and stopping a runaway economy. So, because remember, in the mid 1970s, what have we been through? We had been through the gas wars. We had been through rampant inflation.
Hyperinflation,
devaluation of the dollar. Sound familiar?
20% interest rates.
Yeah, we've been there. Remember back, and then by the time you got to 76 and beyond, Jimmy Carter was talking about malaise and the economy in the doldrums.
And we were all going to have to learn how to live in a condo, in a high-rise condo in a city because no one would be able to afford a home out in the country anymore.
Yep. So basically, folks, this thing's been around for a while, but the big problem is that where the money's coming from. Back then, it was the Ford Foundation and the Rockefellers. Today, we don't have to go very far. We can look at people like George Soros, who funds a plethora of leftist causes, including MoveOn.org and Acorn and other. The ones that you fought against, if you're patriotic or you're part of the Tea Party, you fought against this stuff. But nobody seems to be wanting to fight against the the call for a constitutional convention, which, if you look at a member like ALEC and these other organizations, we've tried. You can't get to their funding sources. They keep those hidden.
That's right.
I have a very major concern, and I'm airing it now, that a lot of that funding is coming through front groups that are being funded by guys like George Soros and Maurice Strong, who's an international financier, who all want the United States Constitution to be eradicated, so it's easier to assimilate the United States into a world government.
Well, one of the things we should ask our state legislators to ask the representatives of the Goldwater Institute and ALEC when they is where the money, the huge amount of money, we already know a gigantic amount of money is being spent to bring these people around the country to print up slick paper, multiple page documents that legislators all get. They get these 40-page
briefings,
tomes,
yes. Mm-hmm.
That, A, they don't read.
That's right. Most of them don't read it.
But nonetheless, they bring in Dr. Nadelson, to tell them what the paper says.
Mm-hmm.
And they bring in other quote-unquote experts, Bill Fruth from ALEC and those kind of guys, to testify in favor of these things. Well, it costs money to fly these guys in. It costs money to put them up in hotels. It costs money to get the legislators out to resort hotels.
Yes.
To sell them on the idea. It costs a lot of money. Yeah. Where's the money coming from?
Well, some will say, well, it comes from corporations and it comes from big business.
Well, what corporations and what big business?
That's exactly the whole point, is that because they protect where they're getting their grants and their money from, you can't find it out. But the key is, the people who have always wanted a constitutional convention, who spent tens of millions of dollars of 1960s and 70s dollars.
That's right.
Which means that's hundreds of millions of dollars today. Well, I mean, think about inflation, ladies and gentlemen.
Right.
You know, in 1964, $2.5 million, that would have been like going into, that would be like a significant endowment for a university today to fund a chair at the university. Or to name a building for a sporting arena.
That's right.
You know, those are the type of numbers we're talking about here. Folks, they don't put investments like that out there just to see them go dry and belly up and dissolve. They continue to work. And if they can't get it in the first shot, if the first round, if the public wasn't ready for it, then we just keep working at it. We create another crisis. We get a handful of folks to keep calling for it. We build, we build, we build until we reach a tipping point. Now, ladies and gentlemen,
that's
we
right.
were on the verge of a tipping point in December of 2008 when the Ohio legislature did this the last time and called for a federal constitutional convention for balancing the budget. Of the 34 states needed, they would have been number 33.
33.
Right. 33. And Virginia then was dialing one up as well to be number 34. In December of 08, we were two states away from a constitutional convention, Article 5 convention being called. Our Institute for Principal Policy, along with a number of other liberty groups, rose to the challenge and we blocked it from happening. It's back again. Now, a number of states have rescinded their calls, but then there's a question, because there are some scholars who are in the camp of wanting a new constitutional convention. That's when they like silence in Article 5. They point to Article 5 and say, well, Article 5 doesn't give a provision for states to rescind their calls once they're made, so therefore they can't rescind their calls and they're valid. And now, what's happened in some states, including Ohio, because they know that people are concerned about this, what they try to write into their language and what Bill Coley wrote into his, that this application constitutes a continuing application. And he says, in accordance with Article 5 of the United States Constitution. There's nothing in Article 5 that talks about resolutions continuing or not continuing.
There's absolutely a dead silence. One thing that we have on our side is parliamentary procedure, which,
yes,
unfortunately, almost nobody knows anything about.
And it's very difficult. I teach classes on parliamentary procedure, and it's a difficult concept to teach, much less to get people to understand it. Now, if you've ever been on a board or you've been part of an organization that uses Robert's Rules of Order, that's parliamentary procedure, ladies and gentlemen. Our legislators use Mason's Legislative Manual of Procedures. But the point is that it's very similar. It's how you conduct and run a meeting and the boundaries of what you can and can't do when making motions and things of that nature. But the point is, in Article 5, there's nothing in it, one way or the other, that says that you can make a continuing call or you can't make a continuing call, that you can rescind a call that was made or that you can't rescind a call that was made. But what we do have is the fact that in our state legislature in Ohio, at the end of every two-year cycle, the legislature adjourns what is called sine die. It's Latin. It means the end of the day. That's the end of that General Assembly. On December 31st of the even-numbered year, when the gavel drops, they adjourn sine die. That means anything out there that wasn't passed into law dies and has to start
goes
all
to
over
the shredder
in the next General Assembly. But the point is, a resolution doesn't have a binding law effect. It's a resolution. It's stating the sense of the legislature. Well, if the sense of the 8th General Assembly right now is that we want to call for a constitutional convention, but in January of 2013, the next assembly that comes in, who honestly may be 80 to 90% of the same folks, but maybe they're not.
Maybe they come back to their district headquarters and they get bombarded by people who are like, what is with
or
you
they get,
voting for a constitutional convention?
Or they call? Get voted out in the previous election because of this. But when that next General Assembly, the 129th, 130th, whatever it might be, comes in and they're sworn in, the day that they open the new two-year session in Ohio, that's a brand new day, ladies and gentlemen. A resolution that expressed the sense and desire of the previous assembly can't bind the conscience of the future General Assembly. So for Senator Coley to say that this application constitutes a continuing application until all 34 states get theirs in, I think is challengeable.
I think so.
In our state, if this ever goes to pass.
Well, remember, this is a model. We have seen, you and I have seen the model that came out of ALEC, American Legislative
Yes.
Exchange Council. And the fact is that ALEC is encouraging legislatures to pass a quote-unquote continuing, in other words, permanent call until the number 34 is reached. There are so many problems with that. So many legal, procedural, ethical problems with that honestly, any legislature that would put that in there needs to rethink his position, because basically what he's doing is he's doing his best to bind someone who may sit in his seat after him.
Right, exactly.
To something that he wanted to do, and his constituents may not have liked to the point where they threw him out, but meanwhile, he's stuck with this resolution. This new guy who's sitting in the seat is stuck with the resolution that his predecessors basically foisted upon him. That is fundamentally wrong.
It is. It's absolutely... Not only is it ethically questionable, the point is that I believe that... And I'm going to be getting some confirmation by talking to some folks who are attorneys for the state legislature on whether or not they can do such a thing and bind a future assembly with a resolution. Now, of course, they can bind future lawmakers if they pass a law, because it becomes part of our laws of our state. And so, therefore, that's what our legislators operate under.
And I suspect that is the argument you're going to get. But
the point is, this is not a law.
It's a resolution. Is not a law.
And basically, To give it the force of law in that respect by making it continuing, I believe runs an ethical gambit, maybe a legal gambit, that I don't believe Senator Coley really wants to run.
No.
And one that we shouldn't run anyway, because what happens if the situation changes and we find out for sure, I'm dead certain, because the smoking gun's right there, that this whole push for constitutional convention is nothing but a front to kill our United States Constitution and put in something like the new state's Constitution. But if this SGR2 passes, no future legislature can do anything about it, because it's a continuing call. And the arguments out there right now among many of the legal scholars is, well, once a state issues a call, they can't rescind it, especially if it's a continuing call. How do you rescind a continuing call? Now, that's a good question. Hopefully, we'll be able to come up with some very good answers for that.
Well, how could you not rescind a continuing call? I mean, the whole idea is that, let's say, there are groups out there that are claiming that there are continuing calls that are still active, and some of them went back to 1792. Well, how can a legislature in 1792 bind, a state legislature from 1792, bind a modern legislature?
Well, you know, in that group, that's the Friends of an Article 5 convention. And honestly, by their own information they've put out, they've discredited themselves.
Well, I actually, at one point, they were claiming that there were something like 19,000 calls for conventions.
I forget, because
the last number was down to 1,700.
Well, they were doing, they were counting every call that a legislature made, even for state conventions, also were counting multiple, if that a state, like Ohio, passed a resolution and sent it to Congress, well, it gets read across the pages of both the Senate record and the House record.
Yeah.
They were counting it each time that it was read into the documents as a separate call.
Well, anytime that the words Constitution, Convention, and Call were used within three paragraphs, they were calling it a Constitutional Convention call.
Yes.
That doesn't work.
Now, it's interesting here. You know, you talked about ALEC and this whole issue and where they're involved with this, and we know they're involved because of part of their Madison Project. I just went to their webpage today, okay? You go to their model legislation page. The ALEC website is currently under transition so we can build you a better website. We apologize for any inconvenience. Members should contact, and they give a name of a staffer there, for any questions or needs as they may have as we go through this transition. Thank you. In other words, if you're a part member of the general public, we don't want you to see what we're doing.
And in fact, you and I did some research in 2008, and it required $2,800 membership to get in and look at the specific documents that they said, you can join up and be a member of ALEC, and so you can see the documents, but we can't give them to you. You know, you're going to have to buy this $2,500 or whatever it was membership. And of course, the Institute for Principal Policy is so nonprofit that it's painful.
Yeah. Now, I did one more quick search here. Well, on Alex's page, you click on the link called Initiatives and you find a pull down menu, and there's one called Restore the Balance. So I clicked on that. And it's their initiative to restore federalism in America, i.e. to put the states back in charge.
Yeah.
What do they have? One side says model legislation for the states. The other side, ALEC model resolutions proposing U.S. constitutional amendments. You click on that link, and it takes you back to their main homepage. You can't get there.
Yeah.
They're not allowing it to be shown. They talk about membership and meetings. That's what it takes you back to. There is nothing there where you can actually look at those particular models. So, ladies and gentlemen, unless you pay $3,000 as either a legislator or a corporation, you can't see what ALEC's proposing for your future liberty.
Yeah,
or lack thereof.
The only people that can look at it are our ALEC members, and basically state legislators are paid for by the state.
Oftentimes, yes. Sometimes they pay for it out of their own campaign pocket.
But it's minuscule. The amount of money that they pay as a state legislator for membership is minuscule. It's outside people they don't want to have looking at it. We had to beg and plead to get a model copy of their Madison Amendment.
That's right. But the point is, right now, you can't go there and get it because things are heating up again, ladies and gentlemen. We're back to having Ohio and other states calling again for a constitutional convention, which in effect will be the death of our liberties in this country. We ask you to call your senator and ask them to vote no on Senate Joint Resolution number 2 in the Ohio Senate.
And we will get something up on our website that gives you the sponsors, and we'll also put up information regarding where you can go to get a hold of, find out who your senator is. In fact, we already have that up, but we'll make it more accessible.
Yes.
And we will make sure that you can use the power that you have. Please call your state senators and ask them to vote no on HJR 2.
SJR 2.
I'm sorry, SJR 2.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, that's it for today. Join us weekdays at 5:30 for our 15-minute principles and policies updates daily to learn more about our freedoms, our liberties, and our form of government. We'll hopefully see you back here next Saturday as well as we do our hour program. Thanks for listening, and for Chuck and for myself, we want to say have a great weekend, and may Lord bless you and keep you as you go. Thanks for listening.
And now, a constitutional moment from the Institute on the Constitution's Michael Perutka.
What is the purpose of government? Try this question out sometime when politics is being discussed at the picnic or the ball game or the cocktail party. It's such a straightforward question that it can really be a stumper. Here's what most people will say if they say anything at all. The purpose of government is to make a level playing field. The purpose of government is to do for people what they can't do for themselves. The purpose of government is to provide a safety net. Some will even say the purpose of government is to provide for the welfare of the children of the state. Of course, not surprisingly, in today's culture, these answers belie a socialist sentiment. But what, in the American view, is the purpose of government? Well, let's look for a moment at what Thomas Jefferson and our founding fathers said the purpose of government was. In our Declaration of Independence, the document that sets forth the reason for separation from the English crown, they said, 1. There is a God. 2. He, God, is the source of our rights. 3. The proper purpose of civil government is to protect and secure these rights. What rights? Well, those God-given rights they just mentioned in the previous sentence. So in the American view, the purpose of government is to protect God-given rights. They went on to say one more pretty important thing. They said that whenever any government fails to do this, the people should, must, alter, or abolish it. While this may sound like a revolutionary statement, this is quintessentially the American view. This has been Michael Anthony Peruca for Institute on the Constitution, bringing you the American view.